We hope this explanation of God's word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. The following sermon was given at St. Matthias Family Church, where Philip Jensen was senior minister.
Listen, that God is loving and faithful is easy to preach and easy to accept. It's sentimentally accepted by our nation, who even do not believe in God. But that God is also angry, that God executes his wrath upon men in the disasters of this world, that is much harder to preach, much harder to hear, and more unpopular. But yet, it's part and parcel of the love and faithfulness of God that he cares enough for his world and his people not to allow immorality and corruption to go unhindered. And it's part of what the Bible reveals to us about the character of God himself, that he is an angry God and righteous, who visits the sins upon the children, the third and fourth generation. Lamentations is an extraordinary part of that revelation of God's character that we have in the Bible. So as to grasp what it's about, let me paint very quickly and briefly the history and the historical background. Briefly, because I hope that we're actually slowly getting the drift of it from the Bible. It's the same background all the time because it's the one biblical story. You see it in Deuteronomy. That's a good place to look to start with, in Deuteronomy chapter 28. Why don't we turn there to start with? You've only just found Lamentation. Well, don't leave Lamentation unguarded. Put a part of your anatomy in there or your blue outline or something and come back to Deuteronomy, which is much easier to find. At least I think it is. It's here somewhere. Yes, Deuteronomy 28. The people have come to the promised land. And at the end of it, of their coming into this promised land, we are told, 28 verse 1, if you fully obey the Lord your God and carefully follow all his commands I give you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. All these blessings will come upon you and accompany you. If you obey the Lord your God, you'll be blessed in the city and blessed in the country. The fruit of your womb will be blessed, and the crops of your land and your young of your livestock, the calves of your herd and the lambs of your flock. Your basket and your kneading troughs will be blessed, and you will be blessed when you come in and blessed when you go out. And so it goes on for some 13 or so verses, 14 verses, of the blessings that will come on the people of God when they live in the promised land in obedience to the word of God. And then verse 15. However, if you do not obey the Lord your God and do not carefully follow all his commands and decrees I am giving you today, all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. You'll be cursed in the city and cursed in the country. Your basket and your kneading trough will be cursed. The fruit of your womb will be cursed. The crops of your land and the calves of your herds and the lambs of your flocks. You'll be cursed when you come in and cursed when you go out. And then for the rest of this chapter, which runs on for some 60-odd verses, 68 verses, we read of the cursings of God that will come upon the people of Israel. How they'll be scattered, how they'll be defeated, how instead of being the first of the nations, they will become the last of the nations, how their children will be sold into slavery and captivity and exile. And so Deuteronomy, when the people come into the promised land, they are presented with a choice. Two ways to live, you could put it. They are presented with a choice. Obey the covenant of God, the word of God, the commands of God, and live in prosperity and blessing. Disobey the commands, the word of God, and live under the curse of God in destruction and captivity. The capital of Israel becomes in David's day, sometime after Deuteronomy, the city Jerusalem. Israel is God's nation, and so the capital city is not just any capital city, it is God's city. It is the city in which God dwells, the city in which he sets up his house, the temple, where his presence is experienced by the people of Israel, who must go up to the city three times a year for the great festive occasions. It is the city of God, God's dwelling place. Come with me into Psalm 48. Psalm 48. There is a chorus that sometimes we unfortunately sing on this psalm. It's a very strange one because it all talks about it's a real estate chorus. Jerusalem is beautiful in situation on the north side and other things like that. Very strange chorus. But let's read the psalm. I won't sing the chorus for you now. I know you're disappointed, but there's going to be enough suffering in this sermon already without me singing to you. Psalm 48. Great is the Lord and most worthy of praise in the city of our God, his holy mountain. It is beautiful in its loftiness, the joy of the whole earth. Like the utmost heights of Zaphon is Mount Zion. Mount Zion is the mountain upon which Jerusalem is built. The city of the great king. God is in her citadels. He has shown himself to be her fortress. When the kings joined forces, when they advanced together, they saw her and were astounded. They fled in terror, trembling seized them there. Pain like that of a woman in labor, you destroyed them like ships of Tarshish, shattered by an east wind. As we have heard, so we have seen. In the city of the Lord Almighty, in the city of our God, God makes her secure forever. Within your temple, O God, we meditate on your unfailing love. Like your name, O God, your praise reaches to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is filled with righteousness. Mount Zion rejoices. The villages of Judah are glad because of your judgments. Walk around Zion. Go around her. Count her towers. Consider her ramparts. View her citadels, that you may tell of them to the next generation. For this God is our God forever and ever. He will be our guide even to the end. See, God lives in Jerusalem, on Mount Zion. And therefore Jerusalem is safe and secure. It's lifted up, it's beautiful, it's glorious. It's the home of God. It is the most wonderful city in all the earth. And because God is in it, because God is protecting it, it will stand forever. The kings will rise up in armies against them. But when they see that this is the city of God, they will flee in terror. They won't be able to stand. It happened under Sennacherib, remember, in the Assyrians. The Assyrians came and surrounded Jerusalem for a considerable period of time, bottling up the city in a siege situation. But then Sennacherib, who had conquered the whole world, beaten the Egyptians, conquered the Middle East, Sennacherib went home. Jerusalem beat him. Why, says the Israelite, well, we know why, because it's God's city. It will stand forever. It is beautiful. It is strong. It is powerful. It is majestic. It is magnificent because God is in our city. Then in a series of raids, 120 or so years after Sennacherib, the city of Jerusalem was defeated. It was defeated by the new world power that had just arisen. The new world power that had come in the place of Assyria from the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, the new world power called Babylon. And Jerusalem, over a period of some 20 years, was defeated consistently by the Babylonians. The temple ultimately was plundered and devastated. The city was gutted, razed to the very ground. And the people were taken into slavery in Babylon. It's in this experience, this Babylonian captivity, that the Book of Lamentations is written. That is the same experience of that psalm that we sang, which really does fit both the music and the words. You see, by the rivers of Babylon, they said to us, sing the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of Zion when we're sitting in Babylon? How can we sing and joy in our hearts about the great city that's above all cities when it's lying flat? How can we sing of the treasures that are ours in the city of God when the treasures are now in the Babylonian king's treasury house? How can we sing of the power of God to safeguard and secure our future forever when God's power seems smaller than the power of the Babylonian gods and kings? How can we sing the songs of Zion with joy in our hearts in Babylon? Here is the great low point in the history of Israel. The Babylonian captivity. when the people of God and the people of the city of God are living as the slaves of the pagans. Lamentation, which we find now, if you can find it, between Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Lamentation is an interesting poem. We won't get the poetic structure, but it's an alphabet poem, if you want to know it. 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, and each verse starts with the next letter of the alphabet in the Hebrew alphabet. Chapter 3 has 3 verses for each letter of the alphabet. It's that kind of poetry. We saw in our reading that it's a kind of poem which is very suited to a play reading, really, as there are different people come in and out of the narrative. There is the narrator, who's third person, who's talking about Jerusalem rather than to Jerusalem, who is dispassionate in his description of what has taken place. There is Zion, personified, the woman, Jerusalem, the mother whose children have been destroyed and who is in anguish and who is very first person and very hurt and agonizing. There are the scoffers, whom we didn't have much of a part, did we? But who do knock away at what has happened and make fun of Jerusalem. And then there's that strange man of chapter 3, the everyman, the soldier, the whatever he is, the one who is an example of the Israelite caught up in the battle who has suffered, as each of them will have. Some, of course, have suggested that that's Jeremiah himself. The kind of poetry that's there is not linear. It doesn't just start at one point and take us along in the narrative to another point. It wanders over and around the themes, going back and forth and back and forth. And there is a general progression, but it's not a straightforward progression. And the same idea will come and be repeated, then forgotten, and then picked up in the same strain later on. And therefore, I'm not going to work through it verse by verse as we go, but rather to pick up the themes of these opening 2.5 chapters up to 3:18. And there are 7 themes, if I can count to H correctly, 7 themes. And in the last of these, God's character, there are several examples of God's character that we have. The first theme that you notice, and you really had to be not listening to notice, the first theme was that of suffering. I mean, it's an appalling passage as it goes in terms of suffering. I mean, it even starts off that way. Deserted lies the city, once so full of people. Like a widow is she who once was great among the nations, she who was queen amongst the provinces has become a slave. Bitterly she weeps at night, tears upon her cheeks. Among all her lovers there's no one to comfort her. All her friends have betrayed her. Affliction, harsh labour, exile, etc. It's suffering that the narrator sees. Suffering that Zion feels and experiences. Look across to chapter 2, verse 20. Chapter 2, verse 20. Look, O Lord, and consider, whom have you ever treated like this? Should women eat their offspring, the children that they have cared for? Should the priests and the prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? Young and old lie together in the dust of the streets. My young men and maidens have fallen by the sword, and you have slain them in the day of your anger, slaughtered them without pity, as you summon to a... It's the suffering that the woman, Zion, is feeling, that the scoffers in 2:15 are rejoicing in. They're rejoicing in it. Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of all the earth? We have swallowed her up, they say. This is the day we've been waiting for. That the soldier, the individual, the everyman in chapter 3, I am the man who has seen affliction by the rod of his mouth. He's made me to walk in darkness rather than light. Down in verse 10, you see, he's like a God's been like a bear lying in wait, like a lion in hiding. He dragged me from the path and mangled me, left me without help, drew his bow, made me the target for his arrows, pierced my heart, and become a laughingstock. There's a terrible one down there in verse 15, 16. He's filled me with bitter herbs, sated me with gall, and broken my teeth with gravel, and trampled. I don't think breaking your teeth with gravel is an appalling way to go. Suffering agony, anguish runs through all of it. The disease, the warfare, the death, the captivity, the loneliness, the ruin. I am a very Australian. And I know that some of you might find this hard to believe, but I'm actually a post-war baby. And therefore, all this is a long way removed from me. It's a long way removed from most of us, isn't it? But yet, throughout the world, it's not removed from people. Throughout the history of mankind, it has been all too common an experience. We don't have many sieges in warfare lately. It tends to be the isolated terrorist blowing up an airport or something like that. But we did have a siege earlier this year, didn't we, in Lebanon, where a refugee camp was bottled up by the opposition and people were starving within it. And in a country like Lebanon, which seems to have been at war forever, although it isn't, that's just our short memories, but seems to have been war, and they've done such dreadful and barbaric things to each other, and it seems to be never-ending in the horror that goes on there. Even in Lebanon, the picture of the siege brought human sympathy. And all kinds of peoples and nations and groups within Lebanon worked hard to bring some kind of relief to the children and the women and the suffering and the sick who were there dying of starvation because they couldn't get out of their camp because they were besieged by the army around about them. Greater efforts were brought to bring compassion to them than anyone, because it is an appalling form of warfare to just slowly let people inside the camp die, and as they come out for relief, to gun them down. It is the most awful way of conducting warfare, though warfare is awful. It's just a natural expression of it, and an all too common one that Jerusalem experienced. The Bible, notice friend, doesn't run away from suffering. It doesn't run away from a world which is real and horrible and wretched. It recounts it even with, to we Australian ears, gory detail. Although, of course, the warfare is more gory than the detail can ever be recounted. But it's here, because the Bible is dealing with real life, real suffering. But it's not just human suffering and ruin that's being recounted for us here. It's Jerusalem's suffering. It's the city of God's suffering. Therefore, much of the suffering is of special intensity, of a special nature. It's more than just average suffering. I mean, pain is pain. Anyone's pain is anyone's pain. But this, in a sense, is worse. Look back in chapter 1, verse 12. Where Jerusalem, Zion, is speaking, "Is it nothing to you, all who you pass by? Look around and see, is any suffering like my suffering that was inflicted on me, that the Lord had brought on me in the day of fierce anger?" The suffering of Jerusalem was worse than any of the other suffering because of who Jerusalem was, not because it actually had more pain decibels recorded on the machine, but because this was the city of God that was becoming the city of destruction. It's picked up in the very opening phrase, you see. How like a widow, chapter 1, how like, verse 1, how like a widow is she who once was great among the nations. She who was the queen amongst the provinces has now become a slave. It's because Jerusalem was the very city of God, was the great centre of the universe, that now its destruction is seen so poignantly to those who are the people of God, who see this as the blackest of days of all history. For it is the great reversal that takes place. Verse 4 of chapter 1. The road to Zion mourns, for no one comes to her appointed feasts. Her gateways are desolate, her priests groan, her maidens grieve, and she is in bitter anguish. Or verse 7. In the days of her affliction and wandering, Jerusalem remembers all the treasures that were hers in the days of old. Or down in verse 10, the enemy lays hands on all her treasures. She saw pagan nations enter her sanctuary. See, it's all a matter of reversal. It was the great city, it's become nothing. It was the rich city, it has become poor. It was the holy city, it has become paganized. It is the great reversal of everything it stood for. It is being ripped apart. Jerusalem's suffering is so wicked. The scoffers pick it up quite rightly in chapter 2, verse 15. You see, you remember that little phrase you read? Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of the whole earth? Psalm 48. That's why I quoted Psalm 48 for you. Because it's in Psalm 48 that the Israelites said, our city is the joy of all the earth. That's what they used to sing. Well, the neighbours, when they see the city go down, they say, oh, look at the joy of all the earth now, eh? You see the nature of their scoffing? It's because Jerusalem was so great that its suffering is so intense, so dreadful. God promised so much on his oath, and yet it is destroyed totally. Even the individual caught in it, the very last of the verses we're looking at tonight, 3:18, he says, my splendour is gone, and all that I hoped from the Lord. Everything that the Lord had promised, that I had hoped for, that would be mine, it's gone. Ever had a big failure? I'm sorry for those of you who haven't had any failure. You must be a terrible pain in the neck to live with. Failures do a wonderful thing for people, don't they? But at the time, they are awful, aren't they? The things that you hoped for, you longed for, you worked for, you expected, that kind of kept you going through the depressing and rough days, to see it all just smashed and destroyed, is that awful, awful, empty feeling, that hopelessness and depression, that blackness that overwhelms you. What this man has seen destroyed is 1,000 years of hope and expectation. Because he is not just an individual just brought up with his own kinds of plans to do his trip of Europe and he's missed out on it now. He is the man of God, the Israelite, the one whom God has taken out of Egypt and across the Red Sea and into the Mount Sinai and being given his covenant and contract law, wandered across the wilderness, established in the land of Palestine, driving out the nations, building the city of God around Jerusalem, around David the great king. He is the one to whom God has promised that you will be ruling the universe in the future. Your nation is God's nation, your city is God's city, your king is God's king, and you will be the rulers of the universe forever. That is what he has been hoping for. That is what he has been longing for. That is what he has been promised and expected. And what has he got? Nothing. The land's gone. The king's gone. The city's gone. God's gone. Why? Why is Jerusalem suffering as it is? The third theme is because of Jerusalem's sinfulness. That is why it suffers. The narrator understands that from the very beginning there in verse 5 of chapter 1. Her foes have become her masters, her enemies are at ease. The Lord has brought her grief because of her many sins. Or in verse 8, Jerusalem has sinned greatly and has become unclean. Zion understands it too. Jerusalem understands that's the reason. Chapter 1, verse 18. The Lord is righteous, she says, yet I rebelled against his commands. Or again in verse 20. See, O Lord, how distressed I am. I am in torment within, and in my heart I am disturbed, for I have been most rebellious. Or in 22. Let all their wickedness come before you and deal with them as you have dealt with me because of all my sins. Sin here is called rebellion, rebellion against God. It is the character of Jerusalem. It was a sinful city who didn't take its sinfulness seriously. Come back to chapter 1, verse 9. Her filthiness clung to her skirts. She did not consider her future. Her fall was astounding. There was none to comfort her. Jerusalem sinned. Jerusalem's sin had led her to an uncleanness, a filthiness that clung to her skirts. But yet, she thought she'd get away with it. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. I'll get away with it. I'll never be caught up. I'll never be held to account. I've got away with it this far. I'll get away with it again and again and again. And they haven't caught me yet. I'll be right. God will never call me to account. It's a great folly, a great foolishness. Sin within her, and yet didn't consider the future. The prophets didn't help. Come across to chapter 2, verse 14, a very important little verse in terms of prophecy and its nature and character. 2:14. The visions of your prophets were false and worthless. They did not expose your sin to ward off your captivity. The oracles they gave you were false and misleading. See what was false and worthless about the prophets? They didn't expose sinfulness. They didn't point out the character of sin. If they'd been able to point out, if the visions of the prophets had been such as to be able to show people their sinfulness, then they possibly would have turned away from their sinfulness and never had to go into captivity. But because the prophets didn't do their task of pointing out the sinfulness of the people, so the people continued in their sinfulness. And as they continued in their sinfulness, so they went into their captivity. False prophets are a great danger to us, always. And you see the problem we have here. You don't want to hear a sermon on hell. You don't want me to speak about God's wrath. You don't want me to tell you about sin. You would love me to talk about love and joy and peace and happiness and how we can all rejoice and feel better and how wonderful you are and how marvellous it is to be amongst you and how great it is to be alive and how just seeing you fills me with that warm inner glow all over and all that kind of garbage. It makes you happy, makes me happy. I'm a big man. You're all saying, oh, isn't he wonderful, the good things he says about me. He's quite right. I am rather wonderful, you know. And he's put the finger right on the spot, you see. And all the power of positive thinking will get us there. But the visions of the false prophets are worthless because they do not get us to turn back from our sinfulness, because they say to us, peace, peace, when there is no peace. They say, we have the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. Fear not, we have the temple of the Lord. But the temple of the Lord is about to be destroyed from top to bottom, ripped off utterly. All the gold taken away, the vessels taken away, and the pagans celebrating their pagan celebrations right there in the heart of God's temple. What's the use of the temple of the Lord? It's only a building after all. No, the false prophets were worthless because they didn't expose the sin of the people and therefore ward off their captivity. It is because of Jerusalem's sin that God acted as he did. And while we would like to soften the blow by blaming the Babylonians, our speakers in Lamentations all agree that it is God who is responsible. Oh, certainly the Babylonians did it. But God was the one who really did it. Sin is so serious that the Lord takes action. Chapter 1, verse 5. Her foes have become her masters. Her enemies are at ease. The Lord has brought her grief because of her many sins. Her children have gone into exile captive before the foe. There is a foe called the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar and all them. There is a foe. But the foe has been raised up by God to do God's work. It is God who has done it. Notice what's said there. The Lord has brought her griefs. Now, it's very important to grasp hold of this, friends, because there's all kinds of people today who will not attribute to God anything that is bad. They'll never attribute to God any suffering or pain. And so they've got this kind of milksop God. You know, the kind of wet one, the wimp, a wimpish God. He wants to do good things for people all the time, but he keeps falling asleep on the job and things go wrong. And he wakes up, you see, and he says, oh, look at the mess. And he comes and cleans up and tidies up all the mess. And then he goes back for his afternoon nap. And when he wakes up, he again sees it's all a mess. So he comes back and cleans up the mess again. He's always running there cleaning up the mess, but he can never create any mess for himself. The sovereign Lord of all the earth creates weal and woe, wealth and woe, the prosperity and disaster. He brings the agony and suffering and grief upon the people of Israel. He sends it. He directs it. He doesn't just let it happen. He doesn't sit back with his hands folded and say, well, if they're going to do it, I'll let them do it. He directed it to happen. He ordered it to happen. He raised up the people by which it happened. The God of the Bible is not wimpish in any shape or form. Look at it in chapter 2, verses 1 to 8 there. Notice who is the subject of all this suffering. The one who creates the suffering, the one who's directed the suffering, subject by that, not the object of the suffering. How the Lord has covered the daughter of Zion with a cloud of his anger. He has hurled down the splendor of Israel from earth to heaven to earth. He has not remembered his footstool in the days of his anger. Without pity, the Lord has swallowed up all the dwellings of Jacob. In his wrath, he has torn down the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought her kingdom and its princes down to the ground in dishonor. In fierce anger, he has cut off every horn of Israel. He has withdrawn his right hand to the right. He has burned it. He is the one who has done it. It is God who brings illness. It is God who brings disaster. It is God who brings famine. It is God who brings earthquake. It is God who brings armies that ravage the land. It is God who is the destroyer in the book of Lamentation. Let us not try and solve the problem of evil in this world by saying that God isn't in control, that God doesn't do the bad bits, he only does the good bits. That is not the biblical resolution to the problem of evil at all. God creates wealth and disaster. They're both in his hands. He is capable and able to do either or both. And so the soldier sees his problem as with God. In chapter 3, verse 1 to 18, the everyman. You see, God has guided him into darkness, in verse 2. He has turned his hand against me again and again, all day long. He has made my skin and my flesh grow old and has broken my bones. He has besieged me and surrounded me with bitterness and hardship. He has made me to dwell in darkness like those long dead. Very important to grasp the God of the Bible. See, there's all kinds of people today who say, you sick? If you're sick, that must mean you're outside of the will of God, outside the plan of God. If you're suffering anything, you're having a hard time, you're in bankrupt, you've got some financial difficulties, well, it must mean that you haven't got enough faith in God. If you have faith in God, well, you wouldn't have those things, you see. But somehow, you've kind of missed out on God's plans. You're moved into some kind of second best experience of the sovereignty of God, because God would never want you to be sick. God would never want you to be suffering. God would never want you to have any difficulties. It couldn't be the plans and purposes of God that anybody could be in any hardship. But such people have never read the book of Lamentation. For it is God who sends the most awful, most wicked suffering of all of history, it would seem, up to this point. There is one worse, of course. One that is prefigured in the book of Lamentation, and that is the day in which God's own Son suffered the wrath of God. God's own Son didn't suffer God falling asleep on the job. God's Son suffered the wrath of God. He who knew no sin was made to be sin. And all God's wrath was visited upon him as he died on the cross, cut off and forsaken by his Father. Oh, our God is a consuming fire. Make no bones about that. It's God's action. And while God was doing all this, he did not help those in need. In fact, all appeals for help went unanswered. Chapter 3, verse 8, the everyman there says that he didn't hear my prayer. It was without pity that he destroyed, just as it was decreed in chapter 2, verse 17. So Zion appeals. You see the woman keeping on appealing to God and to her allies and to anybody else who will listen, of course, for help. But no help comes. Listen to her pathetic cries of appeal there in chapter 1. Where is it? Verse 16. Chapter 1, verse 16 following there. This is why I weep, and with my eyes overflow with tears. No one is near to comfort me, no one to restore my spirit. My children are destitute because the enemy has prevailed. Zion stretches out her hands, but there's no one to comfort her. The Lord has decreed for Jacob that his neighbours become his foes. Jerusalem has become an unclean thing among them. The Lord is righteous, yet I rebelled against his command, says Zion. Listen, all you peoples, look upon my suffering. My young men, maidens, have gone into exile. I have called to my allies, but they have betrayed me. My priests, my elders, perished in the city while they search for food to keep themselves alive. See, Lord, see how distressed I am in my torment within, in my heart. See, everybody she's appealing to, but no one. No one will listen. Because it was God's plan that no one would. It's God's plan that her allies would be her enemies. It's God's plan that she would go down. God himself does not listen to her appeal. Even now in the book, she is still appealing for help, but finding none. Not only does she appeal for help, she appeals for something else, which we find fairly unattractive, but is thoroughly right and also completely natural. She appeals for vengeance. Only comes out once in our little section, but it's down there in chapter 21, verse 21, 22 of chapter 1. People have heard my groaning. There's no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard my distress. They rejoice at what you have done. You do see the agony of it, don't you? There you are down, being kicked. You look up for the people standing around and say, help me, help me, help me. And what do? They say, marvellous, put the boot in, put it in. And they rejoice. Look at the blood, look at the guts, isn't it marvellous? They're rejoicing at what you are suffering. And they're the only ones she can appeal to. They rejoice in what has been done. And so the end of verse 21, may God, you bring that day that you have announced, that day of righteous judgment, that day so that they might become like me. Let all their wickedness come before you. My wickedness has come before you, and look what's happening to me. Well, let their wickedness come before you, Lord, so that you will deal with them just as you have dealt with me according to my sins. My groans are many and my heart is faint. She appeals not only for help, but for vengeance, for the day promised of judgment. Throughout this 2.5 chapters, then, we see a lot about the character of God. Four things I've listed out there in terms of our outline tonight. There are many others we could pick up on, but four major ones. God is clearly sovereign and in control. It's never doubted that God is in control, even though we are speaking of the victory of suffering. Even though this is the victory of the pagans, this is the day when the people of God are put down, the pagans are living it up. Yet it's never doubted that God is in control. You see, we sometimes see the prophet of suffering. We see all around the evil seeming to get ahead and the good seeming to suffer. And we want to say, well, where's God? It's because we don't believe that God is in sovereign control of all of life, the good and the bad, the wealthy and the impoverished, the days of creation and the days of destruction. God is sovereign over all. And therefore, suffering, disaster, does in no way question the existence or power of God. Secondly, you'll notice that God is acting in accordance to his plan and promise. Look at chapter 2, verse 17. The Lord has done, 2:17, the Lord has done what he planned. He has fulfilled his word which he decreed long ago. He has overthrown you without pity. He has let the enemy gloat over you. He has exalted the horn of your foes, the strength of your foes. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 28, When the people came to the promised land, they were told, if you obey the commands of God, then you will live in prosperity and blessing. But if you disobey the commands of God, then you will be scattered abroad among the nations. Instead of being the first of the nations, you'll be the last of the nations. Your children will be sent into captivity. Your city will be besieged. You will be dying of starvation. You'll be tempted to eat your own children. The curses of God in Deuteronomy 28 are all reflected here in the book of Lamentation. In fact, a careful study of Lamentation will show you that Deuteronomy 28 was in the mind of the author, as so many of the little phrases of Deuteronomy 28 are picked up in Lamentation. What God promised back then is now taking place. God is acting in accordance with his plan and promise. Thirdly, God is righteous. He is acting in righteousness. Even Zion recognizes this in 118, chapter 1, verse 18. The Lord is righteous, yet I've rebelled against him. For you and I, when we're angry, we're very rarely righteous. The anger of man doesn't work the righteousness of God, says James. When I'm angry, it's usually because I'm frustrated, ill-tempered, and it's got something to do with the children. Anger actually blows up out of my sinful, impatient character, and it often expresses itself in lack of control, loss of control. In fact, we call it losing your temper, don't we? And that kind of outburst of rage and anger doesn't come out of a righteousness, out of a justice, but out of a self-centeredness. I am being frustrated from achieving the goals I want to achieve, so I knock anything that's there out of the way so that I can get on with what I want to do. Not so the anger of God. God is angry, but his anger is a righteous anger. It's because the people have sinned that he is angry. If you have difficulty with that, then just think of Anita Kobe. The anger that our community feels is a righteous anger in the barbaric murder of that young woman, isn't it? We do feel angry, and we should feel angry. If you can read any of the details of what those men did to that poor girl without feeling anger in you, without saying it shouldn't be like that, something should be done to people who act like that, if you don't feel that, then I hope you keep a long way away from me, because I'm terrified of you. You are totally immoral. You are heartless and ruthless. You should feel anger at such things, because such things are so dreadfully wrong. Now, the trouble with you and me, of course, is we're so sinful, it has to be something appalling like that murder before our anger could ever be righteous. And even then, it's a bit tinged with, I'm better than them, I would never do it. Which, of course, is not true. I would. But it has to be that kind of superiority that gets us going. Even that's tinged with sinfulness. Because God is pure. God cannot tolerate any sin. He is perfect and righteous and holy. It's like dirt. I can stand a fair amount of dirt on my hands, and while it kind of irritates me, it really doesn't matter. But the slightest, smallest speck in my eye, everything has to stop till I get rid of it. My eye has no tolerance at all for dirt. My fingernails, massive tolerance. Can live there for months. My eye, no tolerance. Well, you and I are like fingernails. You know, the amount of dirt that we can cope with is enormous. It just kind of floods all over us and we really don't notice anymore. God is like our eye. The slightest speck is intolerable to him. He cannot function with it. And just as we ultimately must remove the speck from our eye, so God must remove sin from his world. It is a righteous anger, his response. And the fourth thing is that God is angry. God is angry, and his anger is one of action. That passage in chapter 2 there, over and again it speaks of it in verse 1. The cloud of his anger Or in verse 2, without pity the Lord swallowed him up in his wrath. Wrath and anger is an interchangeable word. Verse 3, in fierce anger he has cut them down. Over and again, it's the anger of God that leads to the just retribution and destruction of Babylon, of Jerusalem by Babylon. Well, let's take stock of how far we are here as Christians reading this passage. There are five general conclusions I want us to be picking up tonight, which are there in your outline in summary form, just the word. The first is that the world of terrible suffering and defeat for God's people is not inconsistent, I've given you a double negative there, is consistent with the sovereign and righteous God. That a world of suffering and defeat of God's people even, of the innocent even, is still consistent with the sovereign righteous God. Because in some of this suffering, there may be his judgment, there can be his warning, there can be his faithfulness to his word, there can be the outworking of his plans and purposes. He can be using evil forces to punish his people or to discipline his people or even to bring about the salvation of his people. But in this world of terrible suffering, as there is, God's sovereignty is not questioned. Secondly, that we have provided here in Lamentation a whole vocabulary of wrath and judgment. A whole set of pictures of what judgment is about. Chapter 1:15 talks about tramping in the winepress, the grapes of wrath of which the book of Revelation uses the image in chapters 14 and 19. Or chapter 2, verse 15 talks about the scoffers in the day of trouble, just like the scoffers at the day of judgment when Jesus hung on the cross. Exactly the same are the scoffers in Matthew 27:39. Or again, in chapter 3, verse 15, we read about the wormwood and the gall, 3:15. That every man there, he feels, filled me with bitter herbs, sated me with gall. And of course, it's the same words that he used about Jesus being offered the wormwood and the gall at the time of his crucifixion, which the hymn writer has picked up and said, was it the people whose... sinners whose love can ne'er forget the wormwood and the gall, which most of us always do forget. But that language is picked up out of Lamentation. If we're to understand what is happening in the death of Jesus, Lamentation gives us the vocabulary, the pictures, the ideas, the knowledge of what it is like to be under the wrath of God. It speaks of the day of the Lord. Thirdly, and more importantly than just vocabulary, is ideas. Here is an illustration of retributive wrath, of the righteous anger of God coming forth in retribution, in giving people what they deserve, in paying them what is owed to them. You can pay them what is owed to them if it's to give them blessings. You can pay what is owed to them if it's to give them curses. But you give them what is owed to them. And we who are sinners must be very careful here, because what is owed to sin is punishment by God. Punishment in anger and destruction. That is what is given. Our God is a consuming fire. And therefore, we must be warned against presumption. Let he who thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall. For it is an awful thing, a dreadful thing, to fall into the hands of the living God. Hebrews 10. And so there are great warnings against carelessness, about lack of forethought, about following of false prophets who preach to us nice and comfortable and easy words and make us feel warm and good and happy, but who don't get us to face up to the reality of being held accountable by God for every idle word that we have uttered, as Jesus himself says. It shows that God, who is faithful to his purposes and his promises, will be working out his judgments ultimately in this world. It opens up to us, therefore, a whole way of thinking about people. That is, our world today wants to think of people in terms of being sick rather than sinful. The Bible thinks of them as being sinful, and as a result, suffering sickness sometimes, but being sinful. And so we want to say to those men who committed the dreadful murder that somehow they're sick. Well, in one sense of the metaphoric use of the language, they're sick, yes. We want to say they're psychiatric. Yes, in one sense, they may be psychiatric. But we don't want to say that they're just plain sinful, although we're going to lock them up, because they are. Because the only thing you can do with sinful people is punish them. And that's how we've got to view them. Because that's how we've got to view ourselves. Sickness is not the model for understanding our bad behaviour. Don't blame your poor conditioning, the fact that your mother weaned you too fast. Don't blame your economic background that you're caught up in and it's not your fault. You and I know that we do what is wrong by our own deliberative will. And we are going to be held accountable for what we do by God. If you don't grasp that, you'll never understand what the gospel of Jesus is about. For Jesus ultimately doesn't die for sick people. He dies for sinful people. He doesn't die to rescue us from Medibank. He dies to rescue us from hell, from the judgment of God that he dies. If you do not understand the retributive wrath of God, then the death of Jesus, when he called out, my God, why have you forsaken me, will never make sense. If you do not know the wrath of God, you will never understand the love of God. For the love of God is shown to us in Jesus, his Son, experiencing God's wrath. If God has no wrath, then you won't understand what Jesus was experiencing. You won't understand, therefore, the love of God. If God is not angry with what people do to his world, God doesn't care about his world. His very anger demonstrates his love, nowhere more clearly than in his own son's death. And therefore, it's a very important, the book of Lamentations, in what we've been looking at in the wrath of God, to understand God's great plans and purposes. It's also important to understand how they centre on Jerusalem. For Jerusalem is the scene of both judgment and redemption. And so we have this marvellous ambivalence towards Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the symbol of Jesus under wrath. The temple, he says, rip it down and I will build it again in 3 days. Talking about himself. Jerusalem is the only place that would be suitable for Jesus to die in. Jerusalem is the city of man's sinfulness to be destroyed. And yet, Jerusalem is the picture of heaven, the city of God that will last forever. Oh, not the place in Palestine today of which many people have died and fought and crusades have been waged. That's got nothing to do with heaven. That just happens to be a piece of real estate in the Middle East that I wouldn't buy for all the tea in China. Get shot when you go there. The Holy Land is not holy. The Holy Land is a tourist trap. Heaven is holy. The city was only the image of the heavenly reality. But it is that image. And finally, what must we do? Well, we must understand and relate to God properly. We must take sin seriously. That's what the message is, loud and clear. The people of Jerusalem didn't take it seriously. It just clung to them. And we must look forward to the day of the Lord with that ambivalence, that the greatest day will be the most dreadful day simultaneously. You know, the day in which they crucified my Lord, the day in which they murdered the man I love most of all the people of humanity, that day I call good. The best day in the history of mankind was the day they murdered my Lord. We call it Good Friday. We don't call it Black Friday. We don't call it Bad Friday. We don't call it Dreadful Friday, although it is the blackest, most dreadful day of all history, isn't it? We call it Good Friday because in the judgment of God we see the love of God. For through the judgment of God we are saved. And likewise, on the day in which he returns, it'll be like that, won't it? To those who are being saved, it'll be the most glorious day that has ever come. We see Christ in all his glory. We see the multitude of thousands upon thousands singing his praises. We gather up with all the elect and the saints throughout the centuries. We finally get to meet the great ones that we've heard about and read in the history books. We'll be able to see what the fishermen look like. We'll be able to stand there and sing with the crowd. It'll be a great day. But it'll be the day in which our relatives and our friends go into eternal torment. It'll be a day in which some of us here this night will face the dreadful wrath of God, for we have never accepted his mercy and his forgiveness. It's the most wonderful day in all of the universe, and it's the worst, most horrible day in all of the universe. We must hear about this mercy, mustn't we? We must hear of this gracious side of the story. We must find out how we can come to that day and receive mercy and forgiveness and pardon. We must find where in God's judgment there is any hope for us. If you don't know the mercy of God, then please come and talk to me over about supper time. Please come next week when we actually go on to the love of God in the second half of this book. Read ahead, don't wait till next Sunday. Find out about it. Come and ask us about it. But be assured, if you don't know and understand the mercy of God, you are facing the wrath of God. If it hasn't come yet, that doesn't mean it's not coming. In this lifetime, we get the foretaste of it. The life to come, infinitely worse than any touch of it we have here. It's a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Let's pray. We thank and praise you, Heavenly Father, for your great gift of your Son, Jesus Christ, that he should bear that wrath for us, that we might be forgiven. Our Lord, be with those of us this night who do not know of this. Help us, Father, to understand and find your mercy and your forgiveness. As we hear of the horrible wrath and agony that went through those people, and as we know it's only just a foretaste of the terrible wrath that's coming, help us, Father. Help us to be warned as they weren't, Father. Help us to flee to you for mercy. Help us to know how in Jesus we can find it. And those of us, Father, who know of this mercy, help us never to turn back, but to continue with our trust in you, looking forward to the day of Jesus, and working feverishly that others may too be spared. And we ask it in Jesus' name.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.